Chapter 6. It was the barge that took him off at last. The barge, under Babington, with a powerful crew pulling double-banked right into the eye of the wind.
"Are you all right, sir?"
he shouted, as soon as they saw him sitting there. Stephen made no reply, but pointed for the boat to come round the other side.
"Are you all right, sir?"
cried Babington again, leaping ashore.
"Where is Mr. Nichols?"
Stephen nodded, and in a low croak he said,
"I am perfectly well, I thank you. But poor Mr. Nichols. Do you have any water in that boat?"
"Light along the keg there. Bear a hand, bear a hand."
Water. It flowed into him, irrigating his blackened mouth and cracking throat, filling his wizened body until his skin broke out into a sweat at last, and they stood over him, wondering, solicitous, respectful, shadowing him with a piece of sailcloth. They had not expected to find him alive. The disappearance of Nichols was in the natural course of events.
"Is there enough for all?" he asked in a more human tone, pausing.
"Plenty, sir, plenty. Another couple of breakers," said Bondon. "But, sir, do you think it right? You won't burst on us?"
He drank, closing his eyes to savour the delight.
"A sharper pleasure than love. More immediate. Intense."
In time, he opened them again and called out in a strong voice,
"Stop that at once! You, sir, put that booby down! Stop it, I say, you murderous damned rapparees, for shame! And leave those stones alone!"
"O'Connor, Boguslavsky, Brown, the rest of you, get back into the boat," cried Babington. "Now, sir, could you take a little something? Soup? A ham sandwich? A piece of cake?"
"I believe not, thank you. If you will be so good as to have those birds, stones, eggs, handed into the boat, and to carry the two small boxes yourself, perhaps we may shove off. How is the ship?
Where is it?"
4 or 5 leagues south by east, sir. Perhaps you saw our t'gallants yesterday evening."
"Not I.
Is she damaged? People hurt?"
"Pretty well battered, sir.
All aboard, Bondon?"
"Easy, sir, easy now.
Plum, bundle up that shirt for a pillow.
Bondon, what are you at?"
"I'm coming at the umbrella, sir. I thought as maybe you wouldn't mind taking the tiller."
"Shove off," cried Babington. "Give way."
And the barge shot from the rock, swung round, hoisted jib and mainsail, and sped away to the southeast.
"Well, sir," he said, settling to the tiller with the compass before him, "I'm afraid she was rather knocked about, and we lost some people. Old Tiddyman was swept out of the heads, and 3 of the boys went adrift before we could get them inboard. We were so busy looking at the sky in the west that we never had a hint of the white squall."
"White? Sure, it was as black as an open grave."
"That was the second. The first was a white squall from due south, a few minutes before yours. It often happens near the line, they say, but not so goddamn hard. Anyhow, it hit us without a word of warning. The captain was below at the time in the sail room. Hit us topsail high, almost nothing on the surface, and laid us on our beam ends. Every sail blown clean out of its bolt rope before we could touch the sheets or halyards. Not a scrap of canvas left."
"Even the pendant went," said Bondon.
"Yes, even the pendant went. Amazing. And main and mizzen topmasts and for t'gallant, all over to leeward, and there we were on our beam ends, all ports open and 3 guns breaking loose. Then there was the captain on deck with an axe in his hand, singing out and clearing all away, and she was righted. But we had hardly got her head round before the black squall hit us. Lord!"
"We got a scrap of canvas under the foretopmast," said Bondon,
"and scudded, there being these guns adrift on deck, and the captain wishful they should not burst through the side."
"I was at the weather earing," said Plum, stern oar, "and it took me 1/2 a glass to pass it, and it blew so hard it whipped my pigtail close to the boom iron, took a double turn in it, and Dick Turnbull had to cut me loose. That was a cruel hard moment, sir."
He turned his head to show the loss. 15 years of careful plaiting, combing, encouraging with best Macassar oil, reduced to a bristless stump 3 inches long.
"But at least," said Babington, "we did fill our water casks. Then we rigged a jury mizzen and main topmast, and we've been beating up ever since."
An infinity of details. Babington's low, anxious inquiries after Nichols, the surprisingly ready, philosophical acceptance of his death. More details of yards sprung, bowsprit struck by lightning, great exertions day and night, and Stephen slept, the piece of cake in his hand.
"There she lays,"
said Bondon's voice through his dispersing dream.
They've sent up for T'Gallant. Captain will be main glad to see you, sir. Said you could never last on that rock. On deck all day and night. Hands bout ship every glass. God love us, he said with a chuckle, remembering the ferocious compulsion, the pitiless driving of men three parts dead with fatigue. He was quite upset. He had indeed been quite upset. But the news from the masthead that the returning barge carried an animate surgeon reassured the greater part of his mind. He was still in strong anxiety for Nichols, however, and the two emotions showed on his face as he leant over the rail. Gravity, and yet a flush of pleasure, and a smile that would be spreading. Stephen came nimbly up the side, almost like a seaman.
"No, no, I am perfectly well," he said, "but I am deeply concerned to tell you that Mr. Nichols and the boat vanished entirely. I searched the rocks that evening, the next day, and the next. No trace at all."
"I am most heartily sorry for it," said Jack, shaking his head and looking down. "He was a very good officer."
After a moment, he said,
"Come, you must go below and to bed. Mallister shall physic you. Mr. Mallister, pray take Dr. Matcher in below."
"Let me carry you, sir," said Pullings.
"I will give you a hand," said Hervey. The whole quarter-deck and the greater part of the ship's company were gazing at the resuscitated doctor, his older shipmates with plain delight, the others with heavy wonder. Pullings went so far as to push between the captain and the surgeon and to seize him by the arm.
"I have not the least wish to go below," said Stephen sharply, twitching himself away. "A pot of coffee is all that I require."
He moved a little way aft, caught sight of Mr. Stanhope, and cried,
"Your Excellency, I must beg your pardon for not having kept my engagement with you on Sunday."
"Allow me to congratulate you upon your preservation," said Mr. Stanhope, advancing and shaking hands.
He spoke with more than his ordinary formality, for Stephen was mother naked, and although Mr. Stanhope had seen naked men before, he had never seen one with eyes so reddened by the salt and the intolerable sun that they shone like cherries, nor one so wizened, so wrinkled in his loose, blackened skin, so encrusted and cadaverous.
"I wish you joy of your rescue, Doctor," said Mr. Atkins,
the only man aboard who was not pleased to see the barge return. Stephen was attached to the mission in an artfully vague capacity, and the envoy's instructions required him to seek Dr. Maturin's advice. Mr. Atkins's advice, or indeed presence, was nowhere mentioned, and he was consumed with jealousy.
"May I fetch you a towel or some other garment?"
with a look at Stephen's scrofulous, shrunken belly.
"You are very officious, sir, but this is the garment in which I shall appear before God. I find it answers pretty well. It may be termed my birthday suit." "That has choked the bugger off," said Pullings to Babington, just above his breath, out of a motionless face. "That is one in his bleeding eye."
In the morning he appeared, eager and sharp set, at the breakfast table, on the first stroke of the bell.
"Are you sure you should not stay abed?"
cried Jack.
"Never in life, soul," said Stephen, reaching for the coffee-pot. "Am I not telling you forever that I am well? A slice of that ham, if you please. No, in all sobriety, if it had not been for poor unhappy Nichols, I should have been glad to be marooned. It was uncomfortable. I was roasted, to be sure, but it has done extraordinary things to my sinews, more than the waters of Bath in 100 years. No pain, no awkwardness. I could dance a jig, and an elegant jig, and quite apart from that, what else would have allowed me day after day of detailed observation? The arthropods alone. Before I went to bed last night, before I turned in, I threw down a mass of undigested notes, and merely for the arthropods there were 17 pages. You shall see them. You shall have the maidenhead of my observations."
"I shall be very happy. Thank you, Stephen."
"Then I sponged myself repeatedly from head to foot with fresh water, your blessed fresh water, and I slept. I slept. It was like falling slowly into a bottomless void so deep that this morning I had difficulty in recalling the events of yesterday, a vague recollection of the sick bay that I had to piece together from fragments that came swimming up. I fear I shall have a sad report for you when I have made my rounds this morning."
"Certainly you look less like a burnt offering than you did yesterday,"
said Jack, peering affectionately into his face.
"Your eyes are almost human. But,"
he said, feeling that this was not perfectly civil.
"They will behold a charming sight on deck. We have picked up the southeast trade at last. It is coming more southerly than I could wish, but I believe we shall weather Cape Saint Roch. At all events, we shall cross the line before noon. We've been making 7 and 8 knots since the beginning of the middle watch. Another cup? Tell me, Stephen, what did you drink on that infernal rock?"
"Boiled shit." Stephen was chaste in his speech. Rarely an oath, never an obscene word, never any bawdy. His reply astonished Jack, who looked quickly at the tablecloth. Perhaps it was a learned term he had misunderstood.
"Boiled shit," he said again.
Jack smiled in a worldly fashion, but he felt the blush rising.
"Yes, there was one single pool of rainwater left in a hollow. The birds defecated in it, copiously. Not with set intent, the whole rock is normally deep in their droppings, but enough to foul it with the pitch of nausea. The next day was hotter, if possible, and with the reverberation the liquid rose to an extraordinary temperature. I drank it, however, until it ceased to be a liquid at all. Then I turned to blood. Poor unsuspecting booby's blood, tempered with a little seawater and the expressed juice of kelp. Blood. Jack, this Cape Saint Roch of which you speak so anxiously is in Brazil, is it not? The home of the vampire?"
"I beg your pardon, sir, for interrupting you," said Hervey, appearing at the door, "but you desired me to let you know when the maintogallant was ready to be swayed up."
Left alone, Stephen looked at his nail-less hand, flexed it with great complacency, remarkable intention, precise, unwavering, carried out a delicate operation on the ham with his pocket lancet, and walked forward to the sick bay, observing,
"I could not have done that before I was broiled alive, desiccated, mummified. Bless the sun in his power."
They crossed the line that day, but with muted ceremonies. It was not only the loss of their shipmates and of Mr. Nichols, a loss emphasized by the sale of their clothes at the capstan head, but there was not much spirit of fun in the ship. Badger Bag came aboard with his trident, shaved the boys and the younger hands in a perfunctory manner, mulcted Stephen, Mr. Stanhope, and his people of 6 and 8 pence a head, splashed a fair amount of water about the forecastle and the waist of the ship, and withdrew.
"That was our Saturnalia," said Jack. "I hope you did not dislike it."
"Not at all. I am wholly in favour of innocent mirth. But I wonder you suffered it, with so much work on hand, all these spars, ropes, and sails lying about half destroyed, and time, as you tell me, so precious."
"Oh, you must not interfere with custom. They will work double tides tomorrow. They will be in much better heart. Custom."
"You are hag-ridden by custom in the Navy," said Stephen. "Bells. An esoteric language, I will not say jargon, unmeaning ceremonies. The selling of poor Nichols's clothes, for example, seemed to me gross impiety, and to Mr. Stanhope, too. He is a far more interesting man than you might suppose. Reads, plays a delicate flute. But I have not come here to be prating of the envoy. I have something far graver to tell you. The incessant labours of the last week have exhausted the men. Many who showed no signs of scurvy at the last examination are now affected. Here is my list. Virtually all the raccoons, many surprises, and 4 landsmen. What is worse, the squall in wrecking my storeroom has made the strangest magma of my drugs, to say nothing of the remaining and more than doubtful lime juice. I tell you officially, my dear, and will put it in writing if you choose, that I cannot be answerable for the consequences unless green vegetables, fresh meat, and, above all, citrus fruits are provided within a few days. If I understand you, you mean to skirt the extremity of eastern Brazil, and eastern Brazil," he cried, looking greedily through the open port westwards, "is notoriously supplied with all these commodities."
"So it is," said Jack. "And with vampires."
"Oh, do not imagine I have not examined my conscience," cried Stephen,
laying his hand on Jack's bosom.
"Do not suppose I am unaware of my eagerness to set foot upon the new world at the earliest possible moment. But come and look at my suppurating 5-year-old amputation, my reopening once healthy wounds, my purulent gums, imposthumes, low fevers, livid extravasations."
"I was hardly serious," said Jack. "But the fact is, there are many things I have to take into account."
There were, indeed. This was a very long voyage, and already he had lost a great deal of time. With the Cape in the hands of the Dutch again, he must get right down to the 40s, to the great unfailing westerlies that would carry him into the Indian Ocean at 200 miles a day, to catch the tail of the southwest monsoon somewhere about the height of Madagascar. His orders required him to touch at Rio, which was not much above 1,000 miles away, no great distance if the hard-won trades held true, whereas if he stood in with the land, he might lose them. He would certainly be entangled with the Portuguese officials if he called at Recife, for example. Interminable delay at the best, and at the worst some ugly incident, detention, even violence, they being so very jealous of a foreign man of war anywhere but Rio. Delay, perhaps a row, and even then no certainty of supplies. And although Stephen was speaking in good faith, the dear creature was so passionate a philosopher with his bugs, vampires.
"Let me consider of it, Stephen," he said. "I will come to the sick bay."
"Very well. And as we go, pray consider of this, too. My rats have vanished. The squall did not take them. Their cage was undamaged, but its door was open. I turn my back for 5 minutes to take the air on St. Paul's Rock, and my valuable rats disappear. If this is one of your naval customs, I could wish you all crucified at your own royal yards and flayed alive before you are nailed up. This is not the first time I have suffered so. An asp off Fuengirola, 3 mice in the Gulf of Lyon, rats I had brought up by hand, cosseted since Berry Head, crammed with best double-refined madder in spite of their growing reluctance. And now all is lost. The entire experiment rendered nugatory, utterly destroyed."
"Why did you feed them with madder?"
"Because Duhamel tells us that the red is fixed and concentrated in their bones. I wished to find the rate of penetration and to know whether it reached the marrow. I shall know in time, however. Malister and I will dissect all suitable subjects, for the effect will be passed to those that ate them, of course. And I tell you soberly, Jack, that if you persist in this dogged, self-defeating hurry, 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 clap on more sails, not a moment to be lost, then most of the people will pass through our hands, including, no doubt, that black thief whose very bones will blush for shame."
He uttered these words in a high shriek at the entrance to the sick bay, to make himself heard above the armourer's forge, where they were fashioning a new iron horse, to replace that carried away in the squall. Jack looked at the crowded berth. He breathed the fetid air that no windsail would carry away. He stood by while Stephen and Malister undid bandages and showed him the effects of scurvy upon old wounds. He did not give an inch, even when they led him to their chief witness, the 5-year-old amputated stump. But when they showed him a box of teeth, and sent for their walking cases to see how easily even molars came out, and to make him palpate their rotting gums, he said he was satisfied, and hurried aft.
"Killick,"
he said,
"I shall not be having any dinner today. Pass the word for Mr. Babington."
Here at least was something pleasant, to take the charnel house smell away.
"Ah, Mr. Babington, there you are. Sit down. I dare say you know why I have sent for you."
"No, sir,"
said Babington instantly. It was worth denying everything as long as he could.
"How is your servitude coming along, eh? You must be close on your time."
5 years, 9 months and 3 days, sir."
After 6 years, on ship's books, a midshipman might pass for lieutenant, might change from a reefer, a non-entity discharged or disrated at pleasure, to a godlike commissioned officer. And Babington knew the date, to the very hour.
"Yes. Well, I'm going to give you an order as acting lieutenant in poor Nichols's place. By the time we reach the Admiral, you will have your time and you can sit your board, and I dare say the Admiralty will confirm the appointment. They will never fail you on seamanship, I'm very sure, but it might be wise to beg Mr. Hervey to give you a hand with your double altitudes."
"Oh, thank you, sir," cried Babington, suffused with joy.
It was not wholly unexpected. He had bought one of Nichols's coats on the off chance, but it had been far from certain. Braithwaite, the other senior midshipman, who had bought 2 coats, 2 waistcoats, 2 pair of breeches, had as good a claim to the step, and some sharp words had passed between Babington and his captain at Madeira.
"This ship is not a floating brothel, sir."
A sharper still about relieving the watch in time. It was an exquisite moment, and the kind words with which Jack finished.
"Shaping well, responsible, officer-like. Should feel as easy with Babington keeping a watch as any officer on the ship."
It brought tears to Babington's eyes. Yet in the midst of his joy his heart smote him, and pausing at the door after the usual acknowledgments, he turned and said, in a faltering voice,
"You are so very kind to me, sir. Always have been. That it seems a blackguardly thing. You might not have done it if... But I did not exactly lie, however."
"Eh?"
cried Jack, astonished. In time, it appeared that Babington had eaten of the doctor's rats, and that he was sorry now.
"Why, no, Babington," said Jack. "No. That was an infernal shabby thing to do. Mean and very like a scrub. The doctor has been a good friend to you, none better. Who patched up your arm when they all swore it must come off? Who put you into his cot and sat by you all night, holding the wound? Who?"
Babington could not bear it. He burst into tears. Though an acting lieutenant, he wiped his eyes on his sleeve, and through his sobs he gave Jack to understand that unknown hands had wafted these prime millers into the larboard midshipman's berth, that although he had had no hand in their cutting out, indeed would have prevented it, having the greatest love for the doctor, so much so that he had fought Braithwaite over a chest for calling the doctor a Dutch-built quiz, yet the rats being already dead, and dressed with onion sauce, and he so hungry after rattling down the shrouds, he had thought it a pity to let the others scoff the lot. Had lived with a troubled conscience ever since, had in fact expected a summons to the cabin.
"You would have been living with a troubled stomach if you had known what was in 'em. The doctor had—"
"I tell you what it is, Jack," said Stephen, walking quickly in. "Oh, I beg your pardon."
"No, stay, doctor. Stay, if you please," cried Jack.
Babington looked wretchedly from one to the other, licked his lips, and said,
"I ate your rat, sir. I'm very sorry, and I ask your pardon."
"Did you, sir?" said Stephen mildly.
"Well, I hope you enjoyed it. Listen, Jack, will you look at my list now?"
"He only ate it when it was dead,"
said Jack.
"It would have been a strangely hasty, agitated meal had he ate it before," said Stephen, looking attentively at his list. "Tell me, sir, did you happen to keep any of the bones?"
"No, sir. I'm very sorry, but we usually crunch 'em up like larks. Some of the chaps said they looked uncommon dark, however."
"Poor fellows. Poor fellows,"
said Stephen in a low, inward voice.
"Do you wish me to take notice of this theft, Dr. Maturin?" asked Jack.
"No, my dear, none at all. Nature will take care of that, I am afraid."
He wandered back to the sick bay, and there, when he had carried out some dressings, he asked Mallister how many lived in the larboard midshipman's berth. On being told six, he wrote out a prescription and desired Mallister to make it up into six boluses. On deck, Stephen was conscious of being closely, furtively watched, and after dinner, at a time when he was judged to be in a benevolent frame of mind, he was not surprised to receive a deputation from the young gentlemen, all washed and wearing coats in spite of the heat. They, too, were very sorry they had eaten his rats. They, too, begged his pardon, and they should never do so again.
"Young gentlemen," he said, "I have been expecting you. Mr. Callow, be so good as to take this note with my best compliments to the captain."
He wrote, "Can the services of the young gentleman and the clerk be dispensed with for a day?" I folded it and handed it over. In the interval, he gazed at Meadows and Scott, first-class volunteers aged 12 and 14, the captain's clerk, a hairy 16 with his wrists far beyond the sleeves of his last year's jacket, Jolliffe and Church, 15-year-old midshipmen, all thinner, hungrier than their mothers could have wished. And they gazed covertly back at him, their habitual thoughtless merriment quenched, turned to a pasty solemnity.
"The captain's compliments, sir," said Callow, "and he says with the greatest possible ease, 1 week if you choose." "Thank you, Mr. Callow. You will oblige me by swallowing this bolus. Mr. Jolliffe, Mr. Church."
The surprise lay hove to, the precious trade wind singing through her rigging, fleeting away unused. Abroad on her starboard beam, Cape Saint Roch advanced into the sea, a bold headland so thickly covered with tropical forest that not a patch of bare earth, not a rock, could be seen except at the edge of the sea, where the surf broke upon a shining beach, indented here and there with creeks that ran into the trees. One of these inlets had a stream. Its turbid waters could be seen, mingling with the blue, spreading on either side of the little bar, and by following its course one could make out the roofs of a village some way inland. Just these roofs, nothing more.
The whole of the rest of the New World was ancient, luxuriating forest, a solid mass of different shades of green. Not a wisp of smoke, not a hut, not a track. Jack's telescope, poised on the hammock cloth, brought the forest so close that he could see half-fallen trunks, held in a tangle of gigantic creepers, new trees pushing through, even the flashing scarlet of a bird, the very colour of a blaze of flowers a little to the right, but most of the time he kept it fixed upon the roofs, the stream, hoping hour after hour to surprise a movement there. His idea had seemed brilliant in the morning light, with Brazil looming in the west. They would not go to Recife, nor any other port, but coast along and send the launch ashore at the nearest fishing village. No trouble with any authorities, almost no loss of time. Stephen was convinced that any cultivated stretch of this shore would provide what he needed.
"All we require is green stuff," he said, looking at Cape Saint Roch. "And what, outside the Vale of Limerick, could be greener than that?"
Then they saw these canoes running up the creek and the roofs beyond. As Stephen was the only officer aboard who spoke Portuguese and who could be sure of the sick bay's needs, it was sensible that he should go. But he had had to be persuaded, and on leaving, with a partially concealed wild secret grin on his face, he had sworn upon his honour that he was uninfluenced by vampires, that he should not bring a single vampire aboard. Behind Jack, the work of the ship was going on. They were taking advantage of this pause to new-reeve most of the rigging on the mainmast and to re-stow the booms. But it was going forward slowly, with the boatswain and his mates driving the sparse, dispirited crew with more noise and less effect than usual. The sound of distant wrangling came from the carpenters in the forward cockpit, and Mr. Hervey was in an unusual passion, too.
"Where have you been, Mr. Callow?" he cried. "It is 10 minutes since I told you to bring me the azimuth compass."
"Only at the head, sir," said Callow, glancing nervously at the captain's back.
"The head? The head? Every single midshipman gives me that lame old excuse today. Jolliffe is at the head. Meadows is at the head. Church is at the head. What is the matter with you all? Have you eaten something, or is it a wicked falsehood? I will not have this skulking. Do not trifle with your duty, sir, or you will find yourself at the masthead pretty soon, I can tell you."
6 bells struck, and Jack turned to keep his appointment to drink tea with Mr. Stanhope. He liked the envoy more the better he knew him, though Mr. Stanhope was one of the most ineffectual men he had met. There was something touching about his anxiety to give no trouble, his gratitude for all they did for him in the way of accommodation, his hopelessly misdirected consideration for the hands, and his fortitude. Never a word of complaint after the squall and all its wreckage. Once he had established that Jack and Hervey were connected with families he knew, he treated them as human beings, all the others as dogs, but as good, quite intelligent dogs in a dog-loving community. He was ceremonious, naturally kind, and he had a great and oppressive sense of duty. He greeted Jack with renewed apologies for doing so in the captain's own cabin.
"You must be sadly cramped, I am afraid," he said. "Quite miserably confined. A great trial,"
and poured him a cup of tea in a way that reminded Jack irresistibly of his great-aunt Lettice. The same priestly gestures, the same droop of the wrist, the same grave concentration. They talked about His Excellency's flute, a quarter tone too high in this extraordinary heat, about Rio and the refreshments to be expected there, about the naval custom of having 13 months in the year, and Mr. Stanhope said,
"I have often meant to ask you, sir, why my naval friends and acquaintance so often refer to the surprise as the Nemesis. Was her name changed? Was she taken from the French?"
"Why, sir, it is more a kind of nickname that we have in the service, much as we call Britannia Old Ironsides. You may remember the Hermione, sir, in 97.
"A ship of that name? No, I believe not."
"She was a 32-gun frigate on the West Indies station, and I am sorry to say her people mutinied, killed their officers, and carried her into La Guayra, on the Spanish main."
"Oh, oh, how deeply shocking. I am distressed to hear it."
"It was an ugly business, and the Spaniards would not give her up either. So, to put in a word, Edward Hamilton, who had the surprise then, went and cut her out. She was moored head and stern in Puerto Cabello, one of the closest harbours in the world, under their batteries, which had some 200 guns in them. And the Spaniards were rowing guard, too, since the surprise had stood in with the land, and they were aware of her motions. Still, that night he went in with the boats, boarded her, and brought her away. He killed 119 of her crew, wounded 97, with very little loss, though he was shockingly knocked about himself. Oh, it was a most brilliant piece of service. I would have given my right hand to be there. So the Admiralty changed Hermione's name to Retribution, and in the service people called the surprise the Nemesis, seeing that...
Through the open skylight he heard the masthead hail the deck. The launch had put off from the shore, followed by two canoes. Mr. Stanhope went on for some time, gently prosing away about Nemesis, retribution, just deserts, the inevitability of eventual punishment for all transgressions. Crime bore within it the fatal seeds of the criminal's undoing, and lamenting the depravity of the mutineers.
"But no doubt they were led on, incited by some wretched Jacobin or radical, and plied with spirits, to attack properly constituted authority in such a barbarous fashion. I trust they were severely dealt with."
"We have a short way with mutineers, sir. We hanged all we could lay our hands on, ran him up the yardarm directly, with the Rogue's March playing. An ugly business, however," he added.
He had known the infamous Captain Pigott, the cause of the mutiny, and he had known several of the decent men who had been goaded into it. An odious memory.
"Now, sir, if you will forgive me, I believe I must go on deck to see what Dr. Maturin has brought us."
"Dr. Maturin is returning? I rejoice to hear it. I will come with you, if I may. I have a great esteem for Dr. Maturin, a most valuable, ingenious gentleman. I have no objection to a little originality. My friends often quiz me for it myself. May I beg you to give me your arm?"
Valuable and ingenious he might be, thought Jack, fixing him with his glass, but false he was too, and perjured. He had voluntarily sworn to have no truck with vampires, and there, attached to his bosom, spread over it, and enfolded by one arm, was a greenish, hairy thing, like a mat. A loathsome great vampire of the most poisonous kind, no doubt.
"I should never have believed it of him. His sacred oath in the morning watch, and now he stuffs the ship with vampires, and God knows what is in that bag. No doubt he was tempted, but surely he might blush for his fall."
No blush. Nothing but a look of idiot delight as he came slowly up the side, hampered by his burden and comforting it in Portuguese as he came.
"I am happy to see that you were so successful, Dr. Maturin," he said,
looking down into the launch and the canoes, loaded with glowing heaps of oranges and shaddocks, red meat, iguanas, bananas, green stuff.
"But I am afraid no vampires can be allowed on board."
"This is a sloth," said Stephen, smiling at him. "A three-toed sloth, the most affectionate, discriminating sloth you can imagine."
The sloth turned its round head, fixed its eyes on Jack, uttered a despairing wail, and buried its face again in Stephen's shoulder, tightening its grip to the strangling point.
"Come, Jack, disengage his right arm, if you please. You need not be afraid. Excellency, pray be so good. The left arm, gently disengaging the claws. There, there, my fine fellow. Now let us carry him below. Handsomely, handsomely. Do not alarm the sloth, I beg."
The sloth was not easily alarmed. As soon as it was provided with a piece of hawser stretched taut in the cabin, it went fast to sleep, hanging by its claws and swaying with a roll, as it might have done in the wind-rocked branches of its native forest. Indeed, apart from its candid distress at the sight of Jack's face, it was perfectly adapted for a life at sea. It was uncomplaining. It required no fresh air, no light. It throve in a damp, confined atmosphere. It could sleep in any circumstances. It was tenacious of life. It put up with any hardship. It accepted biscuit gratefully, and pap, and in the evenings it would hobble on deck, walking on its claws, and creep into the rigging, hanging there upside down, and advancing 2 or 3 yards at a time, with pauses for sleep. The hands loved it from the first, and would often carry it into the tops or higher. They declared it brought the ship good luck, though it was difficult to see why, since the wind rarely blew east of south, and that but feebly, day after day. Yet the fresh provisions had their astonishingly rapid effect. In a week's time the sick bay was almost empty, and the Surprise, fully manned and cheerful, had recovered her old form, her high-masted, trim appearance. She returned to her exercising of the great guns, laid aside for the more urgent repairs, and every day the trade wind carried away great wafts of her powder smoke. At first this perturbed the sloth. It scuttled, almost ran, below, its claws going clack, clack, clack in the silence between one broadside and the next. But by the time they had passed directly under the sun, and the wind came strong and true at last, it slept through the whole exercise, hanging in its usual place in the mizzen catharpins, above the quarter-deck carronades, just as it slept through the marine's musketry and Stephen's pistol practice. All through this tedious, tedious passage, even in the northeast trades, the frigate had not shown of her best. But now, with a steady, urgent rush of air, this strong ocean of wind, she behaved like the old Surprise of Jack Aubrey's youth. He was not satisfied with her trim, nor with the present rake of her masts, nor with the masts themselves, far less with the state of her bottom, yet still, with the wind just far enough abaft the beam for the stunsails to set pretty, she ran with the old magical life and thrust, a particular living, supple command of the sea that he would have recognised at once if he had been set down upon her deck, blindfolded. The sun had gone down in a brief crimson blaze. The night was sweeping up from the east over a moonless sky, a deeper blue with every minute, and every wave-top began to glow with inner fire. The acting third lieutenant paused in his strut on the windward side of the sloping quarter-deck and called over to leeward, "Mr. Braithwaite, are you ready with a log there?" Babington did not dare come it very high with his former messmates yet, but he cut many a charming caper over the midshipmen of the starboard berth, balm to his soul, and this unnecessary question was intended only to compel Braithwaite to reply, "All ready and along, sir?" The bell struck. Braithwaite heaved a log clear of the stronger phosphorescence racing down the frigate's side. The line tore off the reel. At the quartermaster's cry he checked the run, jerked the pin, hauled the log aboard and shouted, "We've done it! We've done it! 11 on the nose!" "It's not true," cried Babington, his dignity all sunk in delight. "Let's have another go." They heaved the log again, watched it dwindle in the shining turmoil of the wake, more brilliant now with the darkening of the sky, and with his fingers on the running line, Babington nipped on the 11th knot himself, shrieking, 11!
"What are you at?"
asked Jack, behind the excited huddle of midshipmen.
"I'm just checking Mr. Braithwaite's accuracy, sir," said the third lieutenant. "Oh, sir, we're doing 11 knots! 11 knots, sir! Ain't it prime?"
Jack smiled, felt the iron-taut backstay, and walked forward to where Stephen and Mr. White, the envoy's chaplain, were crouching on the forecastle, braced against the lean of the ship and clinging haphazard to anything, kevils, beckets, even the burning metal of the horse.
"Is it settled yet?"
he asked.
"We are waiting for the agreed moment, sir," said the chaplain. "Perhaps you would be so good as to keep time and see all's fair. A whole bottle of pale ale depends upon this. The moment Venus sets, Dr. Maturin is to read from the first page he opens by the phosphorescence alone."
"Not footnotes," said Stephen.
Jack glanced up, and there against the southern cross, high on the humming t'gallant forestay, was the sloth, rocking easy with the rhythm of the ship.
"I doubt you have too much starlight," he said.
At this speed the frigate's bow wave rose high, washing the lee head-rails with an unearthly blue-green light, and sending phosphorescent drops over them, even more brilliant than the wake that tore out straight behind them, a ruled line 3 miles long, gleaming like a flow of metal. For a moment Jack fixed the glowing spray, as it was whirled inboard and then across the face of the foresail by the currents from the jibs and staysail, and then he turned his eyes westwards, where the planet was as low on the horizon as she could be. The round glow touched the sea, reappeared on the rise, vanished entirely, and the starlight distinctly lost in power.
"She dips!" he cried.
Stephen opened the book, and holding it with the page to the bow wave, he read,
"Speed the soft intercourse from soul to soul, and waft a sigh from Indus to the pole. Mr. White, I exult! I triumph! I claim my bottle! And, Lord, Lord, how I shall enjoy it! Such a thirst! Captain Aubrey, I beg you will share our bottle. Come, lethargy," he called, directing his voice into the velvet sky. "Oh, oh!"
cried the chaplain, staggering into the booms. A fish has hit me! A flying fish hit me in the face!
There is another, said Stephen, picking it up. You notice that your high fishes fly paradoxically with the wind. I conceive there must be an upward draught. How they gleam! A whole flight, see, see? Here is a third. I shall offer it, lightly fried, to my sloth.
I cannot imagine,
said Jack, recovering the chaplain and guiding him along the gangway,
what that sloth has against me. I've always been civil to it, more than civil, but nothing answers. I cannot think why you speak of its discrimination.
Jack was of sanguine temperament. He liked most people, and he was surprised when they did not like him. This readiness to be pleased had been damaged of recent years, but it remained intact as far as horses, dogs, and sloths were concerned. It wounded him to see tears come into the creature's eyes when he walked into the cabin, and he laid himself out to be agreeable. As they ran down to Rio, he sat with it at odd moments, addressing it in Portuguese, more or less, and feeding it with offerings that it sometimes ate, sometimes allowed to drool slowly from its mouth. But it was not until they were approaching Capricorn, with Rio no great distance on the starboard bow, that he found it respond. The weather had freshened almost to coldness, for the wind was coming more easterly from the chilly currents between Tristan and the Cape. The sloth was amazed by the change. It shunned the deck and spent its time below. Jack was in his cabin, pricking the chart with less satisfaction than he could have wished. Progress, slow, serious trouble with the mainmast, unaccountable headwinds by night, and sipping a glass of grog. Stephen was in the mizzen-top, teaching Bondon to write and scanning the sea for his first albatross. The sloth sneezed, and looking up, Jack caught its gaze fixed upon him. Its inverted face had an expression of anxiety and concern.
"Try a piece of this, old cock," he said, dipping his cake in the grog and proffering the sop. "It might put a little heart into you."
The sloth sighed, closed its eyes, but gently absorbed the piece, and sighed again. Some minutes later, he felt a touch on his knee. The sloth had silently climbed down, and it was standing there, its beady eyes looking up into his face, bright with expectation. More cake. More grog. Growing confidence and esteem. After this, as soon as the drum had beat the retreat, the sloth would meet him, hurrying towards the door on its uneven legs. It was given its own bowl, and it would grip it with its claws, lowering its round face into it and pursing its lips to drink. Its tongue was too short to lap. Sometimes it went to sleep in this position, bowed over the emptiness.
In this bucket, said Stephen, walking into the cabin, in this small half-bucket now, I have the population of Dublin, London, and Paris combined. These animalculi. What is the matter with the sloth?
It was curled on Jack's knee, breathing heavily. Its bowl and Jack's glass stood empty on the table. Stephen picked it up, peered into its affable, bleary face, shook it, and hung it upon its rope. It seized hold with one fore and one hind foot, letting the others dangle limp, and went to sleep. Stephen looked sharply round, saw the decanter, smelt to the sloth, and cried,
"Jack, you have debauched my sloth!"
On the other side of the cabin bulkheads, Mr. Atkins said to Mr. Stanhope,
"High words between the captain and the doctor, sir. Hoo-hoo, pretty strong. He pitches it pretty strong. I wonder a man of spirit can stomach it. I should give him a thrashing directly."
Mr. Stanhope had no notion of listening behind bulkheads, and he did not reply, but he could not prevent himself from catching isolated sentiments such as,
"T'es mort crapuleuse! Tu cherches à corrompre mon princeur! Va donc, salope! Espèce de fripouille!"
For the dialogue had switched to French, on the entrance of the wooden-faced killick.
"I hope they will not be late for our whist," he murmured.
Now that the air had grown breathable, Mr. Stanhope's strength had revived, and he looked forward keenly to these evenings of cards, the only break in the unspeakable tedium of ocean travel. They were not late. They appeared at the stroke of the hour, but their faces were red, and Stephen was seen to cheat in order to have the envoy as his partner. Jack played abominably, Stephen with a malignant concentration darting out his trumps like a serpent's tooth. He excelled himself in post-mortems,
showing clearly how his opponents might have drawn the singleton king, saved the rubber, trumped the ace, and the evening broke up with no slackening of the tension. They looked at him nervously as they settled the monstrous score, and with a factitious air of cheerfulness Jack said,
"Well, gentlemen, if the master's reckoning is as deadly accurate as Dr. Maturin's leads, and if the wind holds, I believe you will wake up tomorrow in Rio de Janeiro. I feel the loom of the land. I feel it in my bones."
In the dead hour of the middle watch, he appeared on deck in his nightshirt, looked attentively at the logboard by the binnacle light, and desired Pullings to shorten sail at 8 bells. He appeared again, like a restless ghost, at 5 bells, and backed his topsails for a while. His calculations were remarkably exact, and he brought the frigate into Rio just as the sun rose behind her and bathed the whole fantastic spectacle in golden light. Yet even this did not answer. Even this did not close the breach. Stephen, on being routed out of bed to behold it, observed that it was curious how vulgar nature could be at times. Meretricious ad captandum vulgus effects.
Very much the kind of thing attempted to be accomplished at Astley's or Ranelagh, and fortunately missed of.
He might have thought of other observations, for the Sloth had been very slowly sick all night in his cabin, but at this moment the surprise erupted in flames and smoke, saluting the Portuguese admiral as he lay there in a crimson 74 under Rat Island. Jack went ashore with Mr. Stanhope after breakfast, his bargemen shaved and trim in Senate hats and snowy duck, and himself in his best uniform, and when he came back there was not the least trace of reserve, propitiation, or hauteur in his expression. Bonden was carrying a bag, and from far off the cry of "Post!" went round the waiting ship.
"Captain's compliments, and should be happy if you could spare him a moment," said Church, the rativore.
Then, grasping Stephen's sleeve, he added in an urgent whisper,
"And, sir, please, please, would you put in a good word for Scott and me to go ashore? We have deserved it."
Wondering just how Mr. Church thought he had deserved anything short of impalement, Stephen walked into the cabin. It was filled with a rosy smile, with contentment, and the smell of porter. Jack sat there at his table behind a number of opened letters from Sophia, 2 glasses and a jug.
"There you are, my dear Stephen," he cried. "Come and drink a glass of porter with the Irish Franciscan's compliments. I've had 5 letters from Sophie, and there are some for you, from Sussex too, I believe."
They were lying on a heap of others addressed to Dr. Maturin, and the hand was undoubtedly Sophia's.
"What a splendid hand she writes, don't you find?" said Jack. "You can make out every word. And really, such a style! Such a style! I wonder how she could have got such a style. They must be some of the best letters that were ever wrote. There is a piece here about the garden at Melbury and the pears that I will read to you presently, as good as anything in all literature. But do not mind me, I beg, if you choose to look at yours now. Do not stand on ceremony."
"I will not," said Stephen absently, putting them into his pocket and shuffling through the rest, Sir Joseph, Ramis, Waring, 4 unknowns.
"Tell me, were there any letters for Mr. Nichols?"
"Nichols? No, none. Plenty for the rest of the gunroom, however. Killick!"
"What now, sir?"
said Killick angrily, with a spoon in his hand.
"Gunroom steward, post, and bring another jug. Stephen, just look at this, will you?"
He handed a letter. Mr. Fanshawe presented his compliments to Captain Aubrey, and had the honour to state that he had this day received the sum of £9,755.13.4 from the Admiralty, representing an ex gratia payment to Captain A in respect of the detention of His Most Catholic Majesty's ships Clara, Fama, Medea, and Mercedes. That their lordships did not have it in contemplation to make any payment of head money or gun money, nor for the hulls, and that the above-mentioned sum, less sundry advances as per margin and the usual commission, had been paid into Captain A's account with Messrs. Hawes Banking House.
"It is not what you would call handsome," said Jack, laughing. "But a bird in the hand is worth any amount of beating about the bush, don't you agree? And it pretty well clears me of debt. Now all I need is a couple of moderate prizes, and then upon my word I cannot see what Mother Williams can possibly object to. To be sure, there is not a smell of a merchantman left this side of Batavia. Not lawful prize, I mean, and God preserve me from sending in another neutral. But still, they have some privateers cruising from the Isle of France, and a brush with 1 or 2 of them."
The old eager piratical gleam was in his eye. He looked 5 years younger.
"But, Stephen, I've been thinking about you. I must heave the ship down, restow her. Mr. Stanhope's dunnage and presence are all a who in the afterhold. Get her more by the head, shift all manner of things. And it occurred to me, now you are so amazingly agile, should not you like to take a week's leave and ride into the interior? Jaguars, ostriches, unicorns.
Oh, Jack, how truly good of you! I had to put violence upon myself to come away from Cape Saint Roch, to abandon that vegetable magnificence. The Brazilian forest is the haunt of the tapir, the boa, the peccary. You may find it hard to credit, Jack, but never yet have I beheld a boa.
Boas he had beheld, and handled too. Hummingbirds, fireflies, the toucan in his glory peering from his nest, the anteater and her child, tinted purple by the sunrise over a desolate swamp, armadillos, three kinds of New World monkey, a true tapir he had seen before he came back to the ship at Rio, having worn three horses and Mr. White, his companion, to a shadow. Here, riding at single anchor, he found a strangely altered surprise, with a 36-gun frigate's main mast, her fore and mizzen raked strongly aft, and her sides repainted black and white, the Nelson checker.
"It is a plan of my own," said Jack, welcoming him aboard. "Something between the lively and the old surprise I knew as a boy. It will move her in light airs, with her narrow entrance, do you see, and above all give her an extra knot under a press of canvas. You are going to object to her top hamper, I know."
Stephen was gaping up at an immature parrot.
"But I have tossed out all my shingle ballast and replaced it with pig iron. I cannot tell you how kind the Admiral has been, and we have stowed it low. She is as stiff as— why, as stiff as you can imagine. And if we cannot get an extra knot, I shall be amazed. We may need it, for Lyra was in, and she tells us Lenoir has passed into the Indian Ocean with a ship of the line, two frigates and a corvette. You remember Lenoir, Stephen?"
"Monsieur de Lenoir, who captured us in the Sophie? Yes, yes, I remember him perfectly. A cheerful, polite gentleman in a red waistcoat."
"And a prodigious good seaman, too. But if I can help it, he shall not catch us again, not in his 74. The frigates are another matter. The Belle Poule is a heavy great brute, 40 guns to our 28, and 24-pounders. But the Semillante is smaller, and we should stand a chance with her, if only I can get our people to move brisk and fire straight. That would be something like a prize, eh?"
"Do you apprehend any immediate danger? Have these vessels been seen at the Cape?"
"No, no, they are 10,000 miles away. They have come into the Indian Ocean by the Sunda Strait."
"Then is it not perhaps a little premature to—"
"Not a bit, not a bit. Even from the service point of view, there is not a moment to be lost. The crew is not half worked up, nothing like the livelies, not a patch on the sofas. And then again, you know, I do so long to be married. The idea of being married drives a man, by God. You can have no idea. Married to Sophie, I mean. I beg pardon if I have spoke awkward again."
"Why, my dear, I am no great friend to marriage, as you know. And sometimes I wonder whether you may not set too great a store on a contract compelling you to be happy, whether any arrival can amount to the sum of voyages, whether, in fact, it would not be better to travel indefinitely."
His own letters from Sophia told a wretched tale of persecution. Mrs. Williams's health was really breaking up. The President of the College of Physicians and Sir John Butler were not men to be deceived by vapours or hypochondria, and there were some ugly, ugly symptoms. But her strong, restless mind seemed to have gathered fresh energy. Sometimes touchingly pale and racked with pain, she bore real pain with great fortitude. Sometimes her red, angry self, she was battering her daughter with Mr. Hinksey, the new parson. In an exhausted voice from what she called her deathbed, she would beg her daughter to give up this Captain Aubrey, who would never make her happy, who was going to India, everyone knew why, who was going to India after that woman, and to let her mother die in peace, knowing her safely married and settled in Swiving Rectory, so near at hand, among all their connections, so comfortable, not in seaside lodgings the other end of England or in Peru, married and settled, with a man all her friends approved, a man with handsome private means and brilliant prospects, a man who could make a proper provision for her, and who would look after her sisters when their mother was gone, poor motherless girls, a man to whom Sophie was not indifferent, whatever she might say. Captain Aubrey would soon get over it, if indeed he was not over it already in the arms of some trollop, As his precious Lord Nelson said, every man was a bachelor once he was beyond Gibraltar, and India was a great way beyond Gibraltar, if the Atlas was to be believed. In any case, Admiral Haddock and every gentleman of the Navy she had ever known all said, "Sea water and distance wash love away." They were all of the same opinion. She only spoke for Sophie's good, and she implored her not to refuse this one, this last request, for the sake of her sisters, even if her mother's happiness meant nothing to her. Stephen knew Hinksey, the new rector, a tall, well-looking, gentlemanlike man, a sound scholar. Nothing of the evangelical, amusing, witty, kind. Stephen loved and esteemed Sophie more than any woman he knew, but he expected heroic virtue in no one. Not heroic virtue of long duration, with few allies and they 10,000 miles away. 10,000 miles. And how many weeks, months, even years? Time meant one thing in an active, ever-changing life, quite another in a remote provincial house, cooped up with a strong woman devoid of scruple, convinced of her divine rectitude. In any case, Mrs. Williams's fear and detestation of debt was wholly genuine, and this gave her argument a strength and truth far beyond her ordinary reach. In her quiet, settled part of the country, imprisonment for debt did not happen, and the shocking tales she heard from outlying regions or from the dissolute, giddy metropolis concerned only raffish adventurers, or worse, though her whole childhood had been tinged by whispered apocalyptic accounts of people so abandoned by God as to have lost their capital in the South Sea bubble. By her own efforts, Mrs. Williams, like all the people she knew, might have earned 5 pence a day at weeding or plain sowing, though some of the gentlemen might have done a little better at haysel and harvest. The accumulation of £100 was utterly beyond their powers, that of 10,000 beyond their imagination, and they worshipped capital with an unshakable, uncomprehending, steady devotion, not devoid of superstitious practices. Stephen had reflected upon this at the time of reading Sophie's letters. He had reflected upon it as he walked in the Brazilian forest, gazing at vast cataracts of orchids and butterflies the size of soup plates. He reflected upon it now. The infinitesimal time of thought. The interval was barely long enough for Jack's expression to change from embarrassment to a hint of puzzled anxiety, sensing the motive behind Stephen's words, before a message with the news of the launch putting off with Mr. Stanhope aboard turned it to pleasure and relief.
"I was so afraid we should miss the tide,"
he said, running up the ladder into the swarming anthill on deck. Swarming, but orderly. Whatever he might say about their being only half worked up, the surprises moved about their preparations to get under way with diligent purpose. The raccoon was now forgotten. The landmen had left the plough and the loom far, far behind, and in their battles ashore with the crew of the Lyra, the frigate's liberty men had fought as a body. There was not a man whose straw hat did not fly a ribbon with surprise embroidered on it. The ceremony of reception, Mr. Stanhope never came aboard incognito, the clash of the marines presenting arms, the long-expected order, "Up anchor!" the boatswain's pipe, and the crunch of the soldiers' boots as they ran to their places at the capstan bars. The spell on land, prolonged to the last possible minute, had restored Mr. Stanhope's spirits. But, thought Stephen, looking into his face, it had not done a great deal for his health. It had also taken away his sea legs. He and Stephen were discussing the official letters that had reached him from England and from India when the tide turned against the wind, and the surprise, heading out to sea, began to caper like a rocking horse.
"You will forgive me, Dr. Maturin," he said. "I think I will lie down. I have little hope of its doing any good. I know that in an hour's time this cold salivation will reach its paroxysm, and that I shall become an inhuman being, unfit for decent company for how long? Oh, Lord, how long?"
Stephen stayed with him as long as human comfort was supportable, then left him to his valet and a bucket, observing,
"You will be better soon, very soon. You will grow accustomed to the motion far sooner than you did in the Channel, off Gibraltar. Off Madeira, your sufferings will soon be at an end."
Little did he believe it, however. He had read books of voyages. He had conversed with Pullings, who, sailing with the China-bound East Indiamen, had made this trip several times, and he knew the reputation of the high southern latitudes.
for this was not an ordinary passage to India. The Cape of Good Hope had been handed back to the Dutch with bows and smiles in the year 2. Clearly it would have to be taken from them again, but in the meantime the surprise must run down far to the south of Africa, to the Roaring Forties, make her easting, and so northwards to the waters where the summer monsoon blew. The frigate ran down the trades as though she were determined to make up for lost time. The difference in her sailing was apparent to everyone aboard, easier, faster, more stylish by far. Jack was charmed. He explained to Stephen that she was very like a thoroughbred mare, needed a light, careful hand, had to be steered small, had beautiful manners on a wind, and stayed like a cutter. But a captious fellow might fault her going large, a very slight tendency to steer wild that called for a great attention at the helm to prevent her being pooped.
"I should be sorry indeed to see her pooped,"
he said, shaking his head.
"Was she to broach too? I should not like to answer for that damned foremast yard, nor yet for the mast itself, the only thing I could not replace. You remember the partners, for example?"
Stephen had a vague recollection of Jack striking a marlin spike into wood and soft splinters flying. He too shook his head, looking grave, and in decency he paused a moment before asking when he might reasonably hope to see an albatross.
"Poor dear," said Jack, his mind still with his ship. "I'm afraid she's growing old. All the spirit in the world, but Anno Domini can't be beat. Albatross? Why, I dare say we may sight one before we reach the height of the Cape. I will put in orders that you are to be told the moment an albatross is seen."
Day after day, the figure of the noon altitude rose. 26 degrees 16 minutes. 29 degrees 47 minutes. 30 degrees 58 minutes. Every day the air grew colder. Guernsey frocks and fur hats were seen, pitiably reduced by their passage through the tropics, and the officers' uniforms were no longer a torment to them, and every day, several times every day, Stephen was called on deck to see mollyhawks, Cape pigeons, petrels, for now they were in the rich waters of the South Atlantic, waters that could and did support Leviathan, who might often be seen sporting in the distance. Once, indeed, a bump in the night, a momentary check in the frigate's way showing that they had come into immediate contact with him. South and south forever, beyond the zone where the trades were born, boring steadily through uncertain variable airs, cold, cold airs, towards the Roaring Forties, where the west wind, sweeping without a pause round the whole watery globe, would carry them eastwards beyond the tip of Africa. Week after week of determined sailing, with the sun lower at every noon, lower and, as it were, smaller, brilliant, but with no warmth in it, while at the same time the moon seemed to grow. It was strange to see how quickly this progress took on the nature of ordinary existence. The surprise had not run off 1,000 miles before the unvarying routine of the ship's day, from the piping up of the hammocks to the drumbeat of heart of oak for the gunroom dinner, thence to quarters and the incessantly repeated exercising of the guns, and so to the setting of the watch, obliterated both the beginning of the voyage and its end. It obliterated even time, so that it seemed normal to all hands that they should travel endlessly over this infinite and wholly empty sea, watching the sun diminish and the moon increase. Both were in the pale sky on a memorable Thursday, when Stephen and Bondon resumed their customary places in the mizzen-top, dismissing its ordinary inhabitants and settling down upon the folded stunsails. Bondon had graduated from pot-hooks and hangers far north of the line. He had skimmed his ignoble slate overboard in 3 degrees south. Now he was yard-arm to yard-arm with pen and ink, and as the southern latitude mounted, so his neat hand grew smaller and smaller and smaller.
"Verse," said Stephen. It was an inexpressible satisfaction to Bondon to write in meter. With a huge childish grin, he opened his inkhorn and poised his attentive pen. A booby's quill. "Verse," said Stephen again, gazing at the illimitable blue-grey sea and the lopsided moon above it. "Verse. Then we upon our globe's last verge shall go, and view the ocean leaning on the sky. From thence our rolling neighbours we shall know, and on the lunar world securely pry. By God, I believe I see the albatross!" "Believe I see the albatross," said Bondon's lips silently. "It don't rhyme. Another line, sir, maybe?" But receiving no answer from his rigid teacher, he looked up, followed his gaze, and said,
"Why, so you do, sir. I dare say he will fetch our wake directly and overhaul us. Wonderful great birds they are, though something fishy without you skin 'em. There are some old-fashioned coves that has a spite against them, which they say they bring ill winds." The albatross came nearer and nearer, following the ship's wake in a sinuous path, never moving its wings but coming up at such a pace that what was a remote fleck when Stephen first saw it was an enormous presence by the time Bondon had finished his receipt for albatross pie. An enormous white presence with black wingtips, 13 feet across, poised just astern. Then it banked, shot along the side, vanished behind the cloud of sails, and reappeared 50 yards behind the ship. Messenger after messenger ran into the mizzen-top. "Sir, there's your albatross, 2 points on the larboard quarter!" Ahmet reported it in Urdu, and immediately afterwards his dull blue face was thrust aside by a ship's boy from the quarter-deck with, "Captain's compliments, sir, and he believes he has seen the bird you was asking after." "Maturin, I say, Maturin, here's your albatross!" This was Bose, the purser, clambering up by the power of his hands, trailing his game leg. At last Bondon said, "My watch is called, sir. I must be going asking your pardon, or Mr. Rattray will give me the rub. May I send up a pea jacket, sir? 'Tis mortal cold." "Aye, aye, do, do," murmured Stephen, unhearing, rapt in admiration. The bell struck. The watch changed. One bell. Two bells. Three. The drum for quarters, the beating of retreat. No guns for once, thank God. And still he gazed, and still in the fading light the albatross wheeled, dropped astern, occasionally alighting for some object thrown overboard, ran up in a long series of curves, the perfection of smooth, gliding ease. The days that followed were among the most trying that Stephen had spent at sea. Some of the forecastlemen, old South Sea whalers, were passionate albatross fishers. After his first vehement outburst, they would not offer to do it when he was on deck, but as soon as he went below, a line would be privily veered out, and the great bird would come flapping in to be converted into tobacco pouches, pipe stems, hot dinners, down comforters to be worn next to the skin, and charms against drowning. No albatross ever drowned. As many as half a dozen were following the ship now, and not one of them was ever seen to drown, blow rough, blow smooth. He knew that morally his case was weak, for he had bought and skinned the first specimens. He was most unwilling to invoke authority, but he was much occupied in the sick bay. The opening of case 113, a 3-year-old pork that had seen its time in the West Indies station, had produced something surprising in the dysentery way, 2 pneumonias as well. And in the end, worn out by darting up and down, he appealed to Jack.
"Well, old Stephen," said he, "I will give the order, if you wish, but they won't like it, you know. It's against custom. People have fished for albatrosses and mutton birds ever since ships came into these seas. They won't like it. You'll get wry looks and short answers, and half the older hands will start prophesying woe. We shall run into a widowmaker, or hit a mountain of ice."
"From all I read, and from all Pullings tells me, it would be safe enough to foretell a gale of wind in 40 degrees south."
"Come," said Jack, reaching for his fiddle. "Let us play the Boccherini through before we turn in. We may not have another chance this side of the Cape, with your upsetting the natural order of things."
The wry looks, the reproachful tones, began the next morning. So did the prophecies. Many a grizzled head was shaken on the forecastle with the ominous words, profoundly true and not altogether outside Stephen's hearing,
"We shall see what we shall see."
South and south she ran, flanking across the west wind, utterly alone under the grey sky, heading into the immensity of ocean. From one day to the next the sea grew icy cold, and the cold seeped into the holds, the berth deck, and the cabins, a humid, penetrating cold. Stephen came on deck, reflecting with satisfaction upon his sloth, now a parlour boarder with the Irish Franciscans at Rio, and a secret drinker of the altar wine. He found the frigate was racing along under a press of canvas, lying over so that her deck sloped like a roof, and her lee chains were buried in the foam. 12.5 knots, with the wind on her quarter, royals, upper and lower stunsails, almost everything she had, her starboard tacks aboard, for Jack still wanted a little more southing. He was there, right aft by the taffrail, looking now at the western sky, now up at the rigging.
"What do you think of this for a swell?" he cried.
Blinking in the strong cold wind,
Stephen considered it. Vast, smooth waves, dark, mottled with white, running from the west diagonally across the frigate's course, 200 yards from crest to crest, they came with perfect regularity, running under her quarter, lifting her high, high, so that the horizon spread out another 20 miles, then passing ahead, so that she sank into the trough, and her courses, her lower sails, sagged in the calm down there. In one of these valleys that he saw was an albatross flying without effort or concern. A huge bird, but now so diminished by the vast scale of the sea that it might have been one of the smaller gulls. "It is grandiose," he said.
"Ain't it?"
said Jack.
"I do love a blow."
There was keen pleasure in his eye, but a watchful pleasure too, and as the ship rose slowly up, he glanced again at the topsail stunsail. As she rose, the full force of the wind laid her over, and the stunsail boom strained forward, bending far out of the true. All the masts and yards showed this curving strain. They all groaned and spoke, but none like the twisting stunsail booms. A sheet of spray flew over the waist, passing through the rigging and vanishing over the larboard bow, soaking Mr. Hales, the gunner, as it passed. He was going from gun to gun with his mates, putting preventer breechings to the guns to hold them tighter against the side. Rattray was among the booms, making all fast and securing the boats. All the responsible men were moving about, with no orders given. And as they worked, they glanced at the captain, while he, just as often, put out his hand to test the strain on the rigging, and turned his head to look at the sky, the sea, the upper sails.
"This is cracking on," said Jolliffe.
"It will be cracking off presently," said Church, "if he don't take in."
For a glass and more, the watch on deck had been waiting for the order to lay aloft and reduce sail before the Lord reduced it himself. Yet still the order did not come. Jack wanted every last mile out of this splendid day's run, and in any case the frigate's tearing pace, the shrill song of her rigging, her noble running lift and plunge filled him with delight, a vivid ecstasy that he imagined to be private, but that shone upon his face, although his behaviour was composed, reserved, and indeed somewhat severe. His orders cracked out, sharp and quick, as he sailed her hard, completely identified with the ship. He was on the quarter-deck, yet at the same time he was in the straining stunsail boom, gauging the breaking point exactly.
"Yes," he said, as though a long period of time had not passed, "and it will be more grandiose by half before the end of the watch. The glass is dropping fast, and it will start to blow presently. Just you wait until this sea gets up and starts to tumble about. Mr. Harrowby, Mr. Harrowby, another man to the wheel, if you please, and we will get the flying jib and stunsails off her."
The bosun's pipe, the rush of feet and her tearing speed sensibly diminished. Mr. Stanhope, clinging to the companion ladder cruelly in the way, said,
"It is a wonder they do not fall off, poor fellows. This is exhilarating, is it not? Like champagne."
So it was. With the whole ship vibrating, and a deep bass hum coming from the hold, and the clean, keen air searching deep into their lungs. But well before nightfall, the clean, keen air blew so strong as to whip the breath away as they tried to draw it in, and the surprise was under close-reefed topsails and courses, t'gallant masts struck down on deck, running faster still, and still holding her course southeast. During the night, Stephen heard a number of bumps and cries through his sleep, and he was aware of a change of course, for his cot no longer swung in the same direction. But he was not prepared for what he saw when he came on deck. Under the low, grey, tearing sky, half-driving rain, half-driving spray, the whole sea was white, a vast, creaming spread as far as eye could see. He had seen the Bay of Biscay at its worst, and the great southwest gales on the Irish coast. They were nothing to this. For a moment the whole might have been a wild landscape, mountainous yet strangely regular, but then he saw that the whole was in motion, a vast majestic motion whose size concealed its terrifying, dreamlike speed. Now the crests and troughs were enormously greater, now they were very much farther apart, and now the crests were curling over and breaking as they came, an avalanche of white pouring down the steep face. The surprise was running almost straight before them, east by south. She had managed to strike her mizzen topmast at first light, anything to diminish the wind pressure aft and thus the risk of broaching too, and man ropes were rigged along her streaming deck.
As his eyes reached the level of the quarterdeck, he saw a wave, a green-grey wall towering above the taffrail, racing towards them, swift inevitability. He strained his head back to see its top, curving beyond the vertical as it came, yet still balancing with the speed of its approach, a beard of wind-torn spray flying out before it. He heard Jack call an order to the man at the wheel. The frigate moved a trifle from her course, rose, tilting her stern skywards, so that Stephen clung backwards to the ladder, rose and rose, and the mortal wave swept under her counter, dividing and passing on to smother her waist in foam and solid water, on to bar the horizon just ahead, while the ship sank in the trough, and the shriek of the rigging sank an octave as the strain slackened.
"Seize hold, Doctor!" shouted Jack. "Take both hands to it!"
Stephen crept along the lifeline, catching a reproachful look from the four men at the wheel, as who should say, "Look what you done with your albatrosses, mate," and reaching the stanchion to which Jack was lashed.
"Good morning, sir," he said.
"A very good morning to you. It is coming on to blow."
"What?"
"It is coming on to blow,"
said Jack with greater force. Stephen frowned and looked astern through the haze of spray, and there, whiter than the foam, were two albatrosses racing across the wind. One wheeled towards the ship, rose to the height of the taffrail, and poised there in the eddy not 10 feet away. He saw its mild, round eye looking back at him, the perpetual, minute change of its wing feathers, its tail. Then it banked, rose on the wind, darted down, and its wings raised high, it paddled on the face of an advancing cliff of water, picked something up and shot away along the valley of the wave before it broke. Killick appeared with a sour, mean look on his face, all screwed up against the wind. He passed the coffee pot from the bosom of his jacket. Jack put the spout into his mouth and drank.
"You had better go below," he shouted to Stephen. "Go below and have some breakfast. You may not get another hot meal if it turns nasty."
The gunroom was of the same opinion. They had their table spread with boiled ham, beefsteaks, and a sea pie, all held down as tight as double-row fiddles would hold them, but all mingling their gravy in reckless confusion.
"Sea pie, Doctor," said Etheridge, beaming at him. "I've kept you a piece."
"If you please."
Stephen held out his plate, received the piece on the top of the rise, and as the frigate shot down the face of the wave, so the pie rose in the air. Etheridge instantly pinned it with his practised fork, held it until she reached the trough, and gravity went to work again. Pullings gave him a selected biscuit, and told him with a smile that the glass was falling yet, it had to be worse before it got better, and begged him to blow out his luff while he might. But the purser was telling them of an infallible method of calculating the height of waves by simple triangulation, when Hervey plunged into the gunroom, spouting water like an inverted fountain.
"Oh, dear! Oh, dear!"
he said, throwing his tarpaulins into his cabin and putting on his spectacles.
"Give me a cup of tea, Babington, there's a good fellow. My fingers are too numb to turn the tap."
"The tea has gone by the board, sir. Will coffee do?"
"Anything, anything, so long as it is warm and wet. Is there any sea pie left?"
They showed him the empty dish.
"Well, here's a pretty thing!" he cried. "All night on deck and no sea pie!"
When Ham had mollified him, Stephen said,
"Why did you spend all night on deck, pray?"
"The skipper would not go below, though I begged him to turn in. I could not very well do so with him on deck. I have a noble nature,"
said Hervey, smiling now through the ham.
"Are we in extreme peril, then?" asked Stephen.
"Oh, yes," they assured him, with grave, anxious faces. They were in horrid danger of foundering, broaching to, running violently into Australia. But there was a hope, just a very slight hope, of their meeting with a mountain of ice, and clambering on to it. As many as 6 men might be saved. When they had exercised their wit for some considerable time, Hervey said,
"The skipper is worried about the foretopmast. We went aloft to look at it, and, would you credit it, the force of the wind upon us as we went aloft threw the ship a point off her course. The coking just above the cap is not what any of our friends could wish. And if a cross sea sets in, and we start to roll, I shall start saying my prayers."
"Mr. Stanhope begs Dr. Maturin to spare him a minute when convenient,"
said Killick in his ear. He found them sitting in the cold, dark cabin by the light of a purser's dip. Mr. White, Atkins, a young attaché called Barclay, on chairs with their feet in the water that swilled fore and aft with a dismal sound, all wearing greatcoats, with the collars turned up. and Mr. Stanhope half lying on the couch, servants lurking in the shadows. Apparently they had not been fed, and their spirit stoves would not work. They were all quite silent. Mr. Stanhope was extremely obliged to Dr. Maturin for coming so quick. He did not wish to give the least trouble, but should be grateful if he might be told whether this was the end. A water was coming in through the sides, and a seaman had given his valet to understand that this was the gravest sign of all. One of the young gentlemen had confirmed this to Mr. Atkins, adding that being pooped was more likely than actually foundering or breaking in two, though neither possibility was to be overlooked. What did being pooped imply? Could they be of any use? Stephen said that as far as his understanding went, the real danger lay in a following wave striking the back of the ship such a buffet as to twirl it sideways to the wind, when it would lie down, receive the next wave broadside on, and so be overwhelmed. Hence the necessity for speed, for flying before the wind with all sail that could be set, and for steering with due attention to outrun and to avoid these blows. Yet they were to consider that as the ship was exposed to the full force of the blast when it was on the top of the monstrous wave, so it was sheltered in the hollow some 50 feet below, where, nevertheless, the forward speed must be maintained to enable the ship to be guided in the desired direction and to diminish the relative velocity of the ensuing wave, and that this necessarily called for a nice adjustment of the various sails and ropes in all their complexity. But as far as he could tell, all these things were being done with conscientious diligence, and for his part, under such a commander, with such a crew and such a vessel, he felt no rational apprehension whatsoever. "Captain Aubrey has repeatedly stated in my hearing that the Surprise is the very finest frigate of her tonnage in the Royal Navy." The water coming in was inconvenient, and even disconcerting, but it was a usual phenomenon in such circumstances, particularly in aged vessels. It was what the mariners termed the working of the ship, and he cautioned them against too literal a belief in the words of the sailors. "They take an obscure delight in practising upon us landlubbers." Once he was relieved of the sensation of imminent death, Mr. Stanhope relapsed into the appalling dry sickness that had struck him in the night. As Stephen and the chaplain helped him into his cot, he said, with an attempt at a smile,
"So grateful, not quite suited for sea travel. Never undertake sea voyage again. If there is no way home by land, shall stay in Kampong forever."
But the others grew indignant, shrill and vocal. Mr. White thought it scandalous that government should have sent them in so small a boat, and one that leaked. Did Dr. Maturin realize that it was very cold at sea? Far colder than on land. Mr. Atkins said that the officers he had questioned replied in an off-hand manner or not at all, and that surely the captain should have waited upon His Excellency with an explanation before this. Last night's supper had been disgracefully underdone. He should like to see the captain.
"You will find him on the quarter-deck," said Stephen. "I am sure he will be happy to listen to your complaints."
In the silence that followed this, Mr. Barclay said in a lugubrious tone,
"And all our chamber pots are broken."
Stephen made his way forward to the sick bay, through the soaking, smelly berth deck, where the watch below were sleeping fully clothed, sleeping in spite of the tremendous pitch and the roar, for all hands had been called 3 times that night. He found the usual accidents, the bangs and bruises of a furious storm. One man had been flung against the fluke of an anchor, another had pitched head first down the forehatch as it was being battened down, another had contrived to impale himself on his own marlin spike. But nothing that went beyond the surgeon's powers. What worried them was their worst pneumonia, an elderly seaman named Woods. It had been touch and go with him before the storm, and now the prodigious shaking, the absence of rest, had turned the scale. Stephen listened to his breathing, felt his pulse, exchanged a few low words with Mallister, and finished his round in silence. On deck he found the scene changed once more. The wind had increased, and it had backed 3 points. The nature of the sea had changed. Now, instead of the regular procession of vast rollers, there was a confusion of waves running across, bursting seas that filled the valleys with leaping spray. The underlying pattern was still the same, but now the crests were 1/4 mile apart and even higher than before, though at times this was less evident because of the turmoil between. There were no albatrosses anywhere in sight. Yet still the frigate ran on at this racing speed under the precious scrap of canvas forward, rising nobly to the gigantic waves, shouldering the cross seas aside. The launch had been carried away in spite of the bosun's treble gripes, but there seemed to be no other damage. She was beginning to roll now, as well as pitch, and on each plunge her head and the lee side of her forecastle vanished under white water. All the officers were on deck, wedged into odd corners. Mr. Bowes, unrecognizable in tarpaulins, caught Stephen as a weather lurch knocked him off his balance and guided him along the lifeline to the captain, still standing there by his stanchion. He waited while Jack told Callow to go below and read the barometer, and then said,
"Woods of the afterguard is sinking fast. If you wish to see him before he dies, you must come soon."
Jack reflected, automatically calling out his orders to the men at the wheel. Dared he leave the deck at this stage? Callow came crawling aft.
"Rising, sir," he shouted. "It's risen 2 lines and a half. And Mr. Hervey desires me to say the relieving tackles are hooked on."
Jack nodded.
"That means a stronger blow," he said, glancing at the foretopsail, mould eaten in the tropics. But they had done all they could to strengthen it, and so far the storm canvas held. "I'll come now while I can."
He cast himself off, called the master and pullings to take his place, and blundered heavily below. In the cabin he drank off a glass of wine and flexed his arms.
"I'm sorry to hear what you tell me about poor old Woods," he said,
still in the same hoarse roar. Then, moderating his voice,
"Is there no hope?"
Stephen shook his head.
"I say, Stephen, I hope Mr. Stanhope and his people are not too tumbled about, not too upset."
"No, I told them the Surprise was a capital ship, and that all was well."
"So it is, too, as long as the foretopsail holds. She is the bravest ship that ever swam, and if the glass is right, this will blow out in a couple of days. Come, let us go along."
"Do not be too distressed. It is horrible to see and hear, but he feels nothing. It is a very easy death."
Horrible it was. Woods was a leaden blue, and the animal sound of his laboured breath sounded louder close to than the all-pervading din. He might have recognized Jack. He might not. His open mouth and half-closed eyes showed little change. Jack did his duty, said the words expected of a captain. It touched him to the quick, spent a few moments with the other men, and hurried back to his stanchion. A quarter of an hour, yet what a change! When he went below, the frigate had no more than a 10-degree roll. Now her larboard cathead touched green water, and still they came sweeping up from the black westwards, the gigantic streaming seas taller than ever, impossibly tall, and their foam filled her waist 5 feet deep, while the whole of her forecastle vanished as she plunged. Still she rose, pouring water spouting from her scuppers, every time she rose. More heavily now? In the cabin, one of Mr. Stanhope's servants, half drunk, had managed to blow himself up with a spirit stove. Miserably burnt and shattered by falling against a gun, he was being patched up by the surgeons. Mr. White, Mr. Atkins, and Mr. Barclay, all of whom had struggled earnestly in London to reach this position, sat wedged together on the couch, with their feet tucked up out of the water, staring in front of them, hour after hour. On deck, the day was fading, if that grey, shrieking murk could be called day. Yet still Jack could see the rollers sweeping towards her stern from half a mile away, their white tops clear, their whole length traversed the sky as the frigate rolled, and two monstrous waves, too close to one another, exploded in ruin just astern, to be swept up into a still greater hole that thundered as it came, vast and overwhelming. And above the thunder as it passed, his waiting ear caught a sharp, gun-like crack, a crash forward, and the foremast went by the board. The foretopsail, ripped from its yard, vanished far ahead, a flickering whiteness in the gloom.
"All hands! All hands!"
he roared. Already the ship was steering wild, yawing off her course. He glanced back. They were running down into the trough. Unless they could get her before the wind could get some headsail on her, the next wave would poop her. She would broach to and take the next sea on her beam.
"All hands!"
his voice tearing blood from his throat.
"Pullings! Men into the foreshrouds! It's gone above the cap! Forestaysail! Forestaysail! Come along with me! Axes! Axes!"
In the momentary lull of the deepest trough, he raced along the gangway, followed by 20 men. A cross sea broke over the side, waist deep. They ploughed through, and they were on the forecastle before the ship, slewed half across the wind, began to rise, before the next wave was more than halfway to them. Men were swarming up the weather ratlins, forcing themselves up against the strength of the gale. Their backs made sail enough to bring her head a little round before the sea struck them with an all-engulfing crash and spout of foam, far enough round for the wave to take her abaft the beam, and still she swam. The axes cleared the wreckage. Bondon was out on the bowsprit, hacking at the foretopmast stay that still held fast to the floating mast, slewing the ship around. Holding his breath, Jack swarmed out after him, his head under the foam, feeling for the gaskets of the forestaysail, snugged down tight under the stay. He had it. His hands, many hands, were tearing at the lashings, so tight they would not come.
"Hold on!"
roared in his ear, and there was a strong hand pressing on his neck. Then an unimaginable force of water, a weight and a strength past anything, the third wave that broached the frigate squarely to. The pressure slackened. His head was above water, and now there were more men in the shrouds. Again the thrust of the gale on them brought her head round, helped by a savage cross-sea. But they could not hold there forever. A few more minutes of this, and the shrouds would be swept clear. Down again as she plunged, and running his hand along the sail, he found the trouble. The downhauler had fouled the clue, stray lines from the wreckage in the hanks.
"Knife!"
he roared as his head came clear. It was in his reaching hand. A lightning slash and all sprang free.
"Hold on! Hold on!"
And again the thunder of a falling sea, a mountainous wave, the intolerable pressure on his chest, the total certainty that he must not let go of the sail clutched under him, his legs curled round the bowsprit to hold on. Hold on! Strength going. But here was breath again in his bursting lungs, and he reared up out of the water, bawling,
"Man the halyards! Do you hear me aft? Man the halyards there!"
In slow jerks the sail rose up the stay, filled. They sheeted home. But now she was broadside on, wallowing. Oh, would it be in time? Slowly, heavily she turned, as the forestaysail took the strain, the great wave racing up, turned just enough, and took it on her quarter, rose to the height, and the full blast in the headsail set her right before the wind. Faster and faster she moved, steering nimbly now, for though the last blow had flung the men from the wheel, the relieving tackles held, and the next wave passed harmlessly under her stern. He swarmed in, clinging to the knightheads for a moment as she plunged again, and then he was on the forecastle. It was clear of wreckage, the sail set well. He called the men down from the shrouds and moved along the gangway.
"Any hands lost, Hervey?"
was asked, with his arms round the stanchion.
"No, sir. Some hurt, but they've all come aft. Are you all right, sir?"
Jack nodded.
"She steers better," he said. "Dismiss the watch below. Grog for all hands. Serve it out in the half-deck. Pass the word for the boatswain."
All night. The officers stayed on deck that endless night, or spent a few brief spells in the gunroom, sitting between dreaming and waking, listening gravely, concentrated upon that one triangle of rigid canvas forward. After an hour, Jack found the trembling that had affected his entire body die away, and with it even the consciousness of his body. The wheel was relieved, relieved again, again. Continually his croaking voice called out orders, and twice he sent picked parties forward, strengthening, frapping, making all as fast as ever they could in a night that cut to the bone. A little before dawn the wind veered a point, two points, blowing with sudden flaws, vacuums that hurt his ears. It reached a screaming note more savage than anything he had heard, and his heart hurt him for the staysail, for the ship. An edge of sentiment and self-pity, with Sophia's name hovering on the edge of utterance aloud. Then slowly, slowly, the shriek dropped half a tone. Another, and another. A low, buffeting roar at last, when the faint, straggling light showed a sea white from rim to rim, with a steady procession of great rollers in their due, solemn, ordered ranks once again, vast indeed, but no longer maniac. No cross-sea. Very little roll, and the surprise scudding over the desolation, passing every sea under her counter, her waist with no more than a foot of water swirling about it. An albatross broad on the starboard beam. He cast off his lashings and moved stiffly forward.
"We will ship the pumps, Mr. Hervey, if you please. And I believe we may get a scrap of main topsail on her."
Peace. Peace. Madagascar lay astern, and the cormorants. The shattered hulk that had crept north of the 40th parallel, trailing ends of rope and pumping day and night, was now as trim as art and a limited supply of paint could make her. An expert eye would have seen a great deal of twice-laid stuff in the rigging and an odd scarcity of boats on the booms. It would have stared with amazement at the attachments of the rudder, and it would have noted that in spite of fair and moderate breeze, the frigate carried nothing above her topsails. She dared not. Although with her new foretopmast and her fresh paintwork she looked as pretty as a picture, her inward parts had suffered. Jack spoke so often of her butt-ends and her hanging knees that Stephen said, "Captain Aubrey, your butt-ends and your hanging knees cannot be attempted to be rectified, as I understand you, until you have her docked 3,000 miles away. So may I beg you to clap a stopper over all and to accept the inevitable with a decent appearance of unconcern? If we fall apart, why, we fall apart, and there is the end to it. For my part, I have every confidence of reaching Bombay."
"What I know and what you don't know," cried Jack, "is that I have not so much as a single 10-inch spike left aboard."
"God set a flower upon you, my dear, with your 10-inch spike," said Stephen. "Of course I know it. You have mentioned them daily these last 200 leagues, together with your hanging ends and double-sister blocks, and nightly, too, prattling in your sleep. Bow, bow to predestination, or at least confine yourself to silent prayer."
"Not so much as a 10-inch spike, not a mast or boom but what is fished," said Jack, shaking his head.
And it was true. Yet with an irritating complacency, Mr. Stanhope, his suite, and now even Dr. Maturin, cried out that this was delightful now. That was the only way of travelling. A post-chaise on the turnpike road was nothing in comparison of this. They should recommend it to all their friends. Certainly it was delightful for the passengers. The smooth sea, the invigorating breeze carrying them steadily into warmer airs. But in the latitude of the Isle of France, Jack, his carpenter and boatswain, and all his seaman-like officers, looked out eagerly for a French privateer. A spare topmast or so, a few spars, 100 fathoms of 1.5-inch rope would have made them so happy. They stared with all their might, and the Indian Ocean remained as empty as the South Atlantic, and here there were not even whales. On and on she sailed, in warmer seas but void, as though they alone had survived Deucalion's flood, as though all land had vanished from the earth. And once again the ship's routine dislocated time and temporal reality, so that this progress was an endless dream, even a circular dream, contained within an unbroken horizon and punctuated only by the sound of guns thundering daily in preparation for an enemy whose real existence it was impossible to conceive. Stephen laid down his pistols, wiped the barrels with his handkerchief, and shut the case. They were warm from his practice, but still the bottle hanging from the foreyard arm swung there intact. It was not the fault of the pistols, either. They were the best Joe Manton could produce, and the purser had hit the mark 3 times. It was true that Stephen had been firing left-handed, the right having suffered worse at Port Mahon, but a year ago he would certainly have knocked the bottle down, left-hand or not. Pressing? Trying too hard? He sighed, and pondering over the nature of muscular and nervous coordination, he groped his way up into the mizzen-top. Mr. Atkins gazed after him, more nearly convinced that it would be safe to quarrel with him once they reached Bombay. Reaching the futtock shrouds, Stephen took a sudden determination. If his body would not obey him in one way, it should in another. He seized the ropes that ran outwards to the rim of the platform, and instead of making his way into the top by writhing through them, he forced his person, grunting upwards, a diagonal reversed climb with his back towards the sea, and himself hanging at an angle of 45 degrees, and so reached his goal by the path a seaman would have taken. A sailor, but no landsman, bound by the ordinary law of gravity. Bondon was still peering down the lubber's hole, the way Stephen had always come before, the safe, direct, logical but ignominious road, and his unsuccessful attempt at disguising his astonishment when he turned was a consolation to Stephen's mind. Its element of vanity glowed cherry pink. Mastering a laboured gasp that would have ruined the effect, he said, "Let us go straight to verse." This was all that one inspiration could accomplish, and he paused as if in thought until his heart was beating normally. "Verse," he said again. "Are you ready, Barrett Bondon? Then dash away."
Thus to the eastern wealth through storms we go. But now the Cape once doubled, fear no more. A constant trade wind will securely blow and gently lay us on the spicy shore.
An elegant sentiment, sir, said Bondon. As good as Dibdin any day. If you want to crab it, which far from me be it, you might say the gent was a trifle out in his trade wind, this rightly being the monsoon, as we call it by sea. And as for wealth, why, that's poetic license, or, as you might say, all my eye. Spice, maybe. I'm not saying anything against spice, nor yet spicy shores, though most of them is shit, begging your pardon, in Indian ports. But wealth, I make so bold as to laugh. Why, sir, baiting a few privateers out of the Isle of France and Reunion, there's not a prize for us in this whole Indian mortal ocean, not from here to Java Head, not since Admiral Rainier cleaned up Trincomalee. Unless maybe we take on Admiral Linois on his 74 that chased us so cruel hard in the poor old Sophie. God love us, he was a merry old gentleman. You remember him, sir? Certainly, Stephen remembered him, and that bitter chase in the Mediterranean, the loss of their ship, their capture. Bondon's face changed from smiling reminiscence to stony reserve. He slid his book into his bosom as Mr. Callow's hideous face appeared above the rail with the captain's compliments, and did Dr. Maturin intend shifting his coat?
"Why in God's name would I shift my coat?" cried Stephen. "What is more, I have no coat on at all. Perhaps he thought you might like to put one on for Mr. Stanhope's dinner, sir. A genteel way of alluding to it. It is within minutes of three bells, sir. The sand is almost out, and he particularly begs you, sir, to come down through the... to come down the usual way."
"Mr. Stanhope's dinner," said Stephen in an undertone.
He stood up and stared down at the quarter-deck, where, except for her captain, all the frigate's officers were gathered in their full-dress uniforms. Just so. He had forgotten the invitation. How remote it seemed, that quarter-deck, crowded with blue coats, red coats, and half a dozen black, with the busy check-shirted seamen moving among them. No great distance, vertically, 50 feet or so. But still, how remote. He knew all the men there, liked several of them, loved young Babington and Pullings, and yet he had the impression of living in a vacuum. It came to him strongly now, though some of the upturned faces were winking and nodding at him. He slid his legs through the lubber's hole with a grave expression on his face and began his laborious descent.
So full a ship, so close-packed a world, moving urgently along, surrounded by its own vacuum, each man abominating in his own, no doubt. My journal, reread but yesterday, gives me this same impression, an egocentric man living amidst pale shades. It reflects none of the complex, vivid life of this crowded vessel. In its pages my host, whom I esteem, and his people hardly exist, nor yet the gunroom, he reflected, during intervals of conversation as he sat at the envoy's left, stuffed rapidly into his best coat by Jack's powerful hand, breeched and brushed in 1 minute 20 seconds flat, while the marine sentry, under penalty of death, held the half-hour-glass concealed in his hand to prevent the striking of the bell, as he sat there eating up the last long-preserved delicacies from Mr. Stanhope's store and drinking milk-warm claret in honour of the Duke of Cumberland's birthday. But he was not without a social conscience, and aware that he had caused great uneasiness, that his very, very dirty face and hands reflected discredit upon the ship, he exerted himself to talk, to be agreeable, and even, after the port had gone round and round, to sing. Mr. Bowes, the purser, had obliged the company with an endless ballad on the Battle of the 1st of June, in which he had served a gun. It was said to the tune of, "I was, d'ye see, a waterman," but he produced its slow length in an unvarying tone, neither shout nor cry, but nearly allied to both, pitched in the neighbourhood of lower A, with his eyes fixed bravely on a knot in the deckhead above Mr. Stanhope. The envoy smiled bravely, and in the thundering chorus of "To make 'em strike or die," his neighbours made out his piping treble. The frigate could boast no high standard of musical accomplishment. Etheridge had never really known the tune of his comic song, and now, bemused by Mr. Stanhope's port, he forgot the words too. But when at last he abandoned it, after three heavy falls, he assured them that, well sung, by Kitty Pake, for example, it was irresistibly droll. How they had laughed. But he was no hand at a song, he was sorry to say, though he loved music passionately.
It was far more in the doctor's line. The doctor could imitate cats on the cello to perfection, would deceive any dog you cared to bring forward. Mr. Stanhope turned his worn, polite face towards Stephen, blinking in a shaft of sunlight that darted through a scuttle on the roll, and Stephen noticed, for the first time, that the faded blue eyes were showing the first signs of that whitish ring, the Arcus senilis. But from the far end of the table Mr. Atkins called out,
"No, no, Your Excellency, we must not trouble Dr. Maturin. His mind is far above these simple joys."
Stephen emptied his glass, set his eyes upon the appropriate knot, tapped the table, and began.
"The seas their wonders might reveal, but Chloe's eyes have more, nor all the treasure they conceal can equal mine on shore."
His harsh, creaking voice, indicating rather than striking the note, did nothing to improve the ship's reputation, but now Jack was accompanying him with a deep, booming hum that made the glasses vibrate, and he went on with at least greater volume.
"From native Ireland's temperate coast, remove me farther yet, to shiver in eternal frost or melt with India's heat."
At this point he saw that Mr. Stanhope would not be able to outlast another verse. The heat, the want of air. The surprise had the breeze directly aft, and almost none came below. The tight-packed cabin, the necessary toasts, the noise, had done their work, and the rapidly whitening face, the miserable fixed smile, meant a syncope within the next few bars.
"Come, sir," he said, slipping from his place. "Come a moment, if you please."
He led him to his sleeping cabin, laid him down, loosened his neckcloth and waistband, and when some faint colour began to return, he left him in peace. Meanwhile, the party had broken up, had tiptoed away, and unwilling to answer inquiries on the quarter-deck, Stephen made his way forward through the berth deck and the sick bay to the head of the ship, where he remained throughout the frigate's evening activities, leaning on the bowsprit and watching the cutwater shear through mile after mile of ocean, parting it with a sound like tearing silk, so that it streamed away in even curves along the Surprise's side to join her wake, now 8,000 miles in length. The unfinished song ran in his head, and again he sang beneath his breath, "Her image shall my days beguile, and still my dream shall be." Dream. That was the point. Little contact with reality, perhaps a child of hope, a potentiality, infinitely better left unrealized. He had been most passionately attached to Diana Villiers, and he had felt a great affection for her too, a strong affection as from one human being to another in something of the same case, and that, he thought, she had returned to some degree, all she was capable of returning. To what degree? She had treated him very badly, both as a friend and a lover, and he had welcomed what he called his liberation from her, a liberation that had not lasted, however. No great while after his last sight of her, prostituting herself in a box at the opera, a warm expression by which he meant consciously using her charms to please other men, the unreasoning part of his mind evoked living images of these same charms, of that incredible grace of movement when it was truly spontaneous, and very soon his reasoning mind began to argue that this fault, too, was to be assimilated to the long catalogue of defects that he knew and accepted, defects that he felt to be outweighed, if not cancelled, by her qualities of wit and desperate courage. She was never dull. She was never cowardly. But moral considerations were irrelevant to Diana. In her, physical grace and dash took the place of virtue. The whole context was so different that an unchastity odious in another woman had what he could only call a purity in her. Another purity. Pagan, obviously, a purity from another code altogether. That grace had been somewhat blown upon, to be sure, but there was enough and to spare. She had destroyed only the periphery. It was beyond her power to touch the essence of the thing, and that essence set her apart from any woman, any person he had ever known. This, at least, was his tentative conclusion, and he had travelled these 8,000 miles with a continually mounting desire to see her again, and with an increasing dread of the event. Desire exceeding dread, of course. But, Lord, the infinite possibilities of self-deception, the difficulty of disentangling the countless strands of emotion and calling each by its proper name, of separating business from pleasure. At times, whatever he might say, he was surely lost in a cloud of unknowing, but at least it was a peaceful cloud at present, and sailing through a milky sea towards a possible, though unlikely, ecstasy at an indefinite remove was, if not the fullness of life, then something like its shadow. Peace. Still deeper peace. The languid peace of the Arabian Sea, in the southwest monsoon, a wind as steady as the trades, but gentler. So gentle that the battered surprise had her t'gallants abroad, and even her lower stunsails, for she was in an even greater hurry than usual. Her stores were so low now that for weeks past the gunroom had been living on ship's provisions, salt beef, salt pork, biscuit and dried peas, and the midshipman's berth reported no single rat left alive. What was worse, Stephen and Mallister had cases of scurvy on their hands once more. But the lean years were thought to be almost over. At one time Harrowby had wished to steer for the 9-degree channel and the laxatives, but Harrowby was an indifferent, timid navigator, and Jack, overruling him, had laid her head for Bombay itself. And now they had been running northeast by east so long that by dead reckoning the Surprise should have been 100 miles east of the Western Ghats, another ark stranded in the hills of Poona. But consulting with Pullings, working his lunars again and again, dragging his brighter midshipmen repeatedly through the calculations in search of an error, worshipping his chronometers and making the necessary corrections, Jack was almost certain of his position. Seabirds, native craft far off, a single merchantman that fled, crowding sail on the horizon without waiting to learn if they were French or English, the first sail they had seen in 4 months, and above all, soundings in 11 fathoms, a bottom of shelly white sand like direction bank, strengthened him in his persuasion that he was in 18 degrees 34 minutes north, 72 degrees 29 minutes east, and that he should make his landfall the next day. He stood on the quarter-deck, glancing now over the side, now up at the masthead, where the sharpest eyes and the best glasses in the ship were trained steadily eastwards. Stephen's confidence in Captain Aubrey's seamanship was as entire, as blind as Jack's in the medical omniscience of Dr. Maturin, and untroubled by the cares that now oppressed his friend, he sat in the main chains, as naked as Adam and much the same colour, trailing a purse-net in the sea. The chains, broad planks jutting horizontally from the outside of the ship to spread the shrouds wider than her extreme breadth, provided the most comfortable seat imaginable. He had all the advantage of the sun, of solitude, for the chains were well below the rail, and of the sea, which ran curving past under his feet, sometimes touching them with a warm caress, sometimes sending an agreeable shower of spray over his person. And as he sat, he sang, "Asperges me, domine hyssopo." But those qualities were, of course, most apparent when she was poor, lonely and oppressed. What shall I find now? What development, if indeed I call? Hyssopo et super nivem de albabor, asperges me. A passing sea-snake broke his song, one of the many he had seen and failed to catch. He veered out his line, willing the creature to enter the purse, but an empty purse had no charm for the serpent. It swam on with scarcely a hesitation in its beautifully proud, easy glide. Above and behind him he could hear Mr. Hervey's usually conciliating voice raised in passion, wanting to know whether those sweepers were ever coming aft, whether this bloody shambles was ever going to look like the deck of a man of war. Another voice, low, inward, and confidential, was that of Babington, who had borrowed Stephen's Hindustani phrase-book. Over and over again he was repeating, "Woman, wilt thou lie with me?" in that language, staring impatiently northeastwards. Like many sailors, he could sense the loom of the land, a land with thousands of women upon it, every one of whom might, perhaps, lie with him. "No great guns this evening, Doctor," said Pullings, leaning over the rail. "We are prettying for tomorrow. I reckon we shall raise Malabar Hill before it's dark, and the Admiral lays there in Bombay. We must be shipshape for the Admiral." Bombay. Fresh fruit for his invalids. Iced sherbets for all hands. Enormous meals. The marvels of the East. Marble palaces, no doubt. The Parsees' silent towers. The offices of the commissioners for the former French settlements, counters and factories of the Malabar coast. The residence of Mr. Commissioner Canning. "How happy you make me, Mr. Pullings," said Stephen. "This will be the first evening since 30 South that we shall be spared that inhuman—" "Hush, hush! Do not stir. I have it!"
"Ha, ha, my friend, at last!"
He hauled in his line, and there in the net lay a sea snake, a slender animal shining black and brilliant yellow. Quite amazing.
"Don't you touch her, Doctor," cried Pullings. "She's a sea serpent." "Of course she is a sea serpent. That has been the whole purpose of my fishing ever since we reached these waters. Oh, what a lovely creature." "Don't he touch her," cried Pullings again. "She's deadly poison. I've seen a man die in 20 minutes.
"Land ho!" hailed the lookout. "Land broad on the starboard beam."
"Jump up to the masthead, Mr. Pullings, if you please," said Jack, "and let me know what you see."
A thunder of feet as the whole ship's company rushed to stare at the horizon, and the surprise took on a list to starboard. Stephen held his close-meshed net at a prudent distance. The serpent writhed furiously, coiled, and struck, like a powerful spring released.
"On deck there," roared Pullings. "It's Malabar Hill itself, sir, and I see the island plain."
The serpent, blind out of its own element, bit itself repeatedly, and presently it died. Before Stephen could bring it inboard to its waiting jar of spirit, its colours were already fading. But as it climbed in over the rail, so a waft of air took the frigate's sails aback, a breath of heavy air off the land, with a thousand unknown scents, the green smell of damp vegetation, palms, close-packed humanity. Another world.